This talk was given by Bear Gokhan Bonabacher at the Zen Center of New York City. Gokhan is a senior monastic in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. So many of you know, this fall, this Ango, this training period, we are looking at the Eightfold Path, the original teaching of the Buddha, really the first teaching of the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, which is the fourth truth. And it's been interesting. These teachings are fundamental to Buddhism. They are the heart of Buddhism. And they're not emphasized so much in Zen, or at least as Zen is manifesting here, has been passed down to us, has arrived here in the United States, in the West. You could come here, you could practice Zen, and you could skip over this. You could not hear the Eightfold Path. And yet, turning to them, it's obvious how what we do is this, right? We are practicing the path, this path. And so I've been finding it very helpful to go back to these teachings, which I am familiar with, but to read them again, to study them again, to examine them, to see how they inform my practice. I always find it helpful to go back to the original teachings, to the Buddha's teachings, or the closest is what we have of his actual words, what he taught his students. And these fundamental teachings are not, it's not like these are the basic teachings, like this is where we start. They are where we start, and it's what we continue doing for the rest of our practice, continue clarifying for the rest of our practice, and appreciating that there is a path, right? That there is kind of a diagnosis of the human condition. And then there's a path, there's a path laid out for us. The Buddha said it was an ancient path, and I've been interested to notice that in the way that this is, that he said that in his enlightenment, he sort of was enlightened to the path, right? This wasn't actually a path that he followed necessarily, but that he created, but that he realized. So I have a question around that. I think that that's interesting, right? This didn't start, as the Buddha talks about it, it didn't start with him. He realized this. This is the true path as he realized it, as he awakened to. And the steps of the path are sometimes taken sequentially. So the steps of the path, just to review, are right understanding, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And that they are usually presented in this order and are sometimes in some the lineages or traditions of Buddhist traditions of practice are taken sequentially. And so sometimes there's some emphasis on needing to have some understanding before we begin. So that's why right understanding comes first. And so it's some understanding of, well, what is the path? What are the Four Noble Truths? Some understanding of karma, of cause and effect. In some traditions, you would begin with the moral teachings, with right speech, right action, right livelihood. Was seeing the way that in practicing morality, addressing our speech, our actions, that settles the mind, that sort of settles our life so that we can then turn our attention to meditation. And one of the things that I've been thinking about as I've been studying them is, so is this different from Zen or not? is this what we're doing or not? And kind of, you know, how, where are the different places of emphasis? And I find that helpful to understand what we're doing, what I'm doing, and to see that there are some places that are where there's a little bit of an emphasis that we don't emphasize, and that it can be helpful to be pointed to some sort of in some new directions that aren't new, but just aren't emphasized. And of course, the different, though there is an order, and though in some cases there's sort of some sequence, the different steps of the path overlap and speak to each other, and interpenetrate. And we see that as we take up the path. We need each of the different parts, and we kind of need to be practicing each of the different parts all along the way. And so in Zen, so when you come here, those of you who came here for the first time this morning, you got a little bit of instruction, hopefully a word or two about liturgy, what it is, or at least what it isn't, that it's not worship. But mostly what you get when you come here is instruction in Zazen, how to hold your body, the importance of the posture, sitting in stillness, how to turn your attention inwards, how to work with your mind, with your thoughts, how to begin to concentrate and settle the mind. Because in a sense, that's all you need, right? You don't need to understand the whole path. Zazen, the power of Zazen is its directness. And that's the emphasis in Zen, is you can just turn to your mind, see your mind, and see into the nature of your mind, and liberate your mind, liberate your thoughts, liberate your attachments. So I wanted to look at a couple of different teachings that I've come across this fall that are part of right effort. And I was initially, sort of these caught my eye initially because they seemed different. I was, you know, my first reaction was that that's not what we do. Right? These ways, these sort of different practices that we'll look at. They seemed like different ways of working with the mind, working with the places where we get stuck. But I think that's not true, as I've looked at them a little bit more. And I think they're helpful. So the first teaching that I wanted to look at is called the two kinds of thought. And so this is the Buddha speaking. He says, "Practitioners, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nirvana. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I considered this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nirvana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it." And so, you know, I'm first struck by just how sort of relatable this is. You get through the language a little bit. So this is the Buddha himself, before his enlightenment, but still the Buddha himself, Shakyamuni, who's sitting down in meditation. That's what this abiding thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. That's, he's sitting down, he's doing Zazen. Diligent, he was diligent, right? The most diligent. And sitting there in meditation, thoughts of desire arose in him, or thoughts of ill will, of anger, or thoughts of cruelty arose in him. He had fantasies of the things that might taste good, or feel good, or make him happy. He got angry. Sitting there, diligent, ardent, resolute, he had angry thoughts. He even had thoughts of cruelty, and I think that's an interesting translation, but so having angry thoughts, getting angry at someone, does that mean that he then thought about how he'd like them to suffer too? And so this should all sound familiar. We all experience these things in zazen. When we're sitting, diligent, resolute, awake, aware. And he realized, this leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. These kinds of thoughts obstruct wisdom, cause difficulties, lead away from nirvana. And when he considered in this way, he saw that that helped him to let go. It helps the thoughts to subside, seeing that they were not helpful to him. And so whenever an unwholesome thought arose in his mind, he let it go. He abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. And so my first thought when I saw this teaching is that's different, right? Because in zazen, we're not labeling our thoughts. We're not identifying them as positive or negative, afflicting or not afflicting. Right? The instruction is simply to see a thought, whatever the thought may be, not to worry so much about the content of the thought, just to see the thought, and we're able to let it go. And I think that this is, you know, in Zen, the emphasis is not so much on the content of the thought, because what is ultimately sort of what we're being pointed towards is seeing into the nature of thought, seeing into the empty nature of thought, seeing that thoughts are empty. That's what liberates them, is seeing that. That's what liberates us, allows us to release our attachment. And that's an important teaching. There's a reason that's been passed down to us. We don't need to be so concerned with the content of our thoughts in zazen. But just whatever the thought is, to see it without judgment, to see it clearly, and to let it go, and to see that you can let it go. But as we study our mind, we also see that different thoughts are different. Different thoughts have different effects. There are particular thoughts that have more power than others do. Particular types of thoughts that have more power than others. And so this is what the Buddha is pointing to, trying to help us with, to point us to these, to greed, to aversion, these thoughts that come out of greed and aversion, that these have a particular power, right? This is the second noble truth. Right, suffering is caused by our greed, by our aversion, or wanting things to be other than they are. And so these thoughts in particular lead to suffering, to affliction, and away from liberation. And hopefully, in doing zazen, we're also learning, seeing, as we get to know our thoughts and get to know our mind, seeing how karma works. Which simply means seeing that thoughts have an effect. When we fuel our thoughts, a particular thought, give ourselves over to it, give energy to it, we're making that habit stronger. Right? We're creating karma. And so the Buddha later in this sutra says this. He says, practitioners, whatever a practitioner frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of sensual desire, they have abandoned the thought of renunciation in order to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then their mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. Right? And the same thing for ill will, the same thing for cruelty. And so this is why it's so important that we, in doing zazen, are actually practicing letting go. Actually practicing. So that we're loosening our attachments. That we are actually letting go. Because I suppose in a sense we're always creating something. And so we can in zazen actually be cultivating, be deepening our attachment if we're not letting go. Kind of deepening our belief in those thoughts, in those habits. And it's interesting in the sutra that when thoughts of renunciation, or as it's stated, non-ill will or non-cruelty, so love and compassion, that when these thoughts arise in the Buddha's mind, he simply sees that these thoughts are not to be feared. They will not hinder him or cause affliction. They aid wisdom, thoughts. Right? There are thoughts that aid wisdom and lead to nirvana, lead to liberation, help to liberate us. But he doesn't fuel them or follow them or sort of concentrate on them. And I thought it was interesting because he says that he realizes that excessive thinking and pondering might tire his body and strain his mind. And so instead of focusing, pondering, thinking, he simply steadies his mind. He simply returns to concentration. Right? Let's go with the thought, comes back to his practice, back to his breath, back to the focus of his practice. And so he's pointing simply to these human places where we tend to get stuck. These kinds of thoughts, these tendencies in us, greed, aversion, liking, not liking, that have power and lead to suffering, always lead to suffering. And so one of the things that he's offering in this teaching is to notice that when he sees, when we see, is what he's offering, that these kinds of thoughts are not helpful, that they're not leading us to liberation. That just seeing that fact, right, because we're wanting liberation. We're wanting to be free. And so seeing that these are not helpful, that in itself, identifying them in that way, that in itself helps to lessen their power, helps us to let them go. That this is an antidote that he's offering to us in working with these difficult thoughts. And I was thinking about that in my experience, you know, that's helpful. And it's still, we have to see it over and over and over again. The same thing in seeing into the emptiness of thoughts. That doesn't mean that they're just gone. Right? We can truly see into the emptiness of something, into that our fantasies are just wisps, but we pick them up again. Right, we go back, right back to them. So what does it take for us to be, truly to be convinced? Right? We have to really be convinced so that we can let things go, really let them go, and turn the tide of our conviction. I was thinking about how in my early years of sitting, and for a number of years, just how much time I spent, it felt like I was powerless sometimes not to get lost in pleasurable fantasies and not to get, and the many hours and periods of zazen that I sat just being angry, right? Just sort of thoughts and just feelings. And that it took a long time for that to start to turn, for me to see that there was a, that I wasn't powerless, to start to turn things. And I think that, you know, when we experience that, particularly if new, earlier in practice, it's just that we're like accessing something that's always been there, right? That we're seeing what's happening. And that there's some things that I don't know if they ever go away. Greed and anger. I've never met someone that never gets hooked, right? Like greed and anger. We have to keep practicing. These have deep roots, deep conditioning. The other teaching that I wanted to look at is called the Four Great Endeavors. And so the four great endeavors are to prevent the arising of unarisen, unwholesome states, to abandon unwholesome states that have already arisen, to arouse wholesome states that have not yet arisen, and to maintain and perfect wholesome states that have already arisen. And so again, these are part of the Buddha's teachings on effort. Right, so we need effort in practice. It takes effort. It takes doing. The Buddha sometimes talks about this as striving. That's another translation of effort. So we need effort, but how? How do we apply effort? What does that mean? How do we direct our energy? And so in the Buddha's teaching, an important part of what he points to in right effort is to turning our attention towards unwholesome and wholesome states. So in our body-mind experience, our life, what is wholesome and what is unwholesome? The states of mind that are wholesome and unwholesome. And so first, what does that mean? What is being pointed to? I think it's important here to so simply wholesome, what is wholesome is what leads to liberation, what leads to freedom, to non-grasping. And what is unwholesome is what is what hinders us, what makes us more attached. And so we could also call these skillful and unskillful, helpful and not helpful. Really the same criteria that the Buddha was pointing to in looking at two kinds of thoughts. But I think it's important that we have some awareness here of our tendency of then falling into judgment of ourself, of our mind, of our thoughts, to see that wholesome and unwholesome is not quite good and bad, right? It gets translated that way. Sometimes it's translated as good and evil. But to be careful with that, that this is, that our thoughts, so that we're careful to see that it's not that our thoughts, if our thoughts are unwholesome, it doesn't make us unwholesome or bad. Right? Just to see that tendency. And that it's hard to, you know, I think it's important because I, you know, certainly this is something that I see in myself, you know, that we have this view, right, of seeing things as good or bad. And it's hard to even to see that that is a view, right? So just to sort of call that out. You know, in Buddhism, there's no sin in Buddhism. And I was thinking about that. I don't have experience with a tradition where there is sin, but that, you know, we're kind of, if there were sin, we're in trouble. Like you're kind of, because you can't stop having these kinds of thoughts, right? We're responsible for them. We are responsible for our actions, for our speech, for our thoughts. But we can't, at the same time, we can't, you know, control them. We're not trying to control them. We're trying to work with them, shift the tide, shift our habits. But these are human tendencies. And so the Buddha taught about two kinds of thoughts. Here he's talking about states of mind. So in a sense, what thought leads to, you know, thought stream, the bodily experience, in some cases. And so I wanted to look particularly at the first two of these four endeavors. And so the first is to prevent the arising of unarisen wholesome states. And so this is also referred to as restraining. This is to restrain, the endeavor to restrain. And the unwholesome states in particular that are being pointed to here are the five hindrances of desire again, ill will again, and also sloth and torpor, restlessness and doubt. And the desire and the ill will, again, are what are most strong, are the strongest, because they come directly from greed and aversion. And so again, we're being pointed to this constant, what happens constantly, our constant desire and aversion, greed and hatred. Sometimes it's really obvious, sometimes it's pretty subtle, but it's pretty constant. And so again, just an encouragement here from the Buddha to keep looking at that. It comes up over and over again in the teachings. This is really the heart of what we're trying to address. This is where our attachment is. And so this teaching on restraint is looking at something very particular. And so desire or aversion arise when we come in contact with something through our senses, right? We're in contact with the world always through our senses. And so we come in contact and there's a response. We like it or we don't like it. And then usually we get involved with that, right? That leads to more. It gets more complicated. There's a story that comes up around why we like it or why we don't like it. There's an explanation to ourselves or to others. We get involved. And so first, there's just a simple direct experience. There is direct experience. We eat something that has a taste. We see something that has a form. We hear a sound. And so what this teaching on restraint is pointing to is then what happens? How can we not move from there, from just the simple experience, to what comes next? Really to the desire, to the craving, to the aversion, to the not liking. And so this talked about is protecting the senses. And this doesn't mean not feeling. It doesn't mean closing the senses. We can't really do that. It's just talking about being mindful, paying close enough attention. And this takes practice, constant practice, to see this process, to see what's happening, so that there's a possibility not to jump from that direct experience into what comes after, into the hating or the grasping. That thing that we encounter, it's just that thing. It doesn't mean anything. Sweet is just sweet. Hot is just hot. So to study that, how do we interrupt that? How do we get some space there? we were talking about desire and attachment on Thursday evening in the Zen Essential Seminar, and someone said, oh, that's like anger management. And I found it was really interesting to me, right? So this sort of a modern understanding of mind. It's the same understanding of mind. And that the teaching in anger management, again, so how do you get this, allow there to be some space? Someone bumps into you, someone says something to you, something happens that maybe is painful in some way. That's a little more complicated, right? It's a little more complicated than just like tasting something, right? But this is what's happening in our life all the time, right? Something happens. All it was actually when that person bumped into you was the sensation of that person bumping into you and maybe moving your body a little bit, right? But what happens after that so quickly? What comes after that? And so the strategy that was that's being offered in this anger management is just to see, allow there to be some space there. You don't have to react. You don't have to get angry. Right? That all comes after. That's all coming from your body, mind, habit, response. Right? Where is the problem actually? And this also requires some not wanting to be angry. Right? Some disenchantment, some convincing of ourselves internally that that's not actually what we want, that that's not helpful to us, to others, to anyone. Because we're pretty convinced that pleasure and anger, right, are kind of what we want. That's why we keep going back to them. And so that's where reflecting on these teachings is a really helpful first step. And then we have to really study that. And that's the, again, the power of Zazen, of the direct seeing of Zazen, that we can see directly in Zazen that that thought that was so pleasurable is not so pleasurable. That that anger that we were caught in, you know, for period after period of Zazen, but then where did it go? What did it do? That didn't help me. That just made me feel this way. So to really, how do we convince ourselves again? And I have a little bit of response, of sort of reaction to a teaching on restraint. This goes away against what we're usually taught in our culture. And so I think that that's worth noting as well. And yet we all are constantly exercising restraint, right? We have to exercise restraint. I was thinking about when I used to live here at the temple and would go to the grocery store, Brooklyn Fair, and there's this kind of amazing like deli prepared food section that you have to walk by to get to the rest of the grocery store. And every time I would walk in there, I would be like, I want all of that. But of course, I restrained myself, right? We're constantly doing that. I would walk by, do the grocery shopping. And of course, in Zazen, we're practicing restraint. That's what we're doing. Right? A thought arises. That's the contact. That's the sense, right? Mind is a sense. So contact with this mental object. And the restraint is not to stop the thought from arising. So again, we're not trying to stop our thoughts. That's not what's being pointed to here. You really can't do that. We're not trying to stop any of our senses. The restraint is just not getting involved. Right? Like, don't pick that up. You don't need to think about the thought. You don't need to have a reaction to the thought, a judgment of the thought. Again, in practicing restraint, the content doesn't matter, right? Just don't pick it up. Don't get involved. You can let it pass. It is passing. Just let it pass. And again, because you know and we have to convince ourselves of this and study this, that when you do get involved, when you do pick it up, what's going to happen, right? It's going to take you away and become bigger, become more complicated. And as we develop concentration, it's easier to do that. And as we develop concentration, the thoughts do slow down. We're not stopping the thoughts, right? But the thoughts do slow down. The mind does settle. And so the second of the four endeavors is to abandon unwholesome states that have already arisen. So the practice of abandoning, which really is just letting go. And so thoughts do arise. And sometimes, or a lot of the time, we get involved. We grab on. The thought proliferates. We get caught up. Before we notice, before we realize, we're involved. We're having a reaction. One thought is leading to another. And so seeing that, simply, when we become aware of that, we see that, we let go, we abandon. So I think that's all he's saying here. Again, whatever the content doesn't matter. Just to see that we've become involved. And the Buddha is pointing again to the fact that there are particular thoughts that are particularly hindering to us. That as human beings we get stuck in. That have a particular power to obscure and kind of to confuse us. To beguile us. And so to know for ourselves, to learn for ourselves, what are the states that we fall into? The unwholesome states that arise and then a particular need to be abandoned. Many years ago, I was asking Shugen, before he was Shugen Sensei, I think, or Roshi, about working with depression. And just asking him, how do I work with this, what I might now call an unwholesome, unhelpful state of mind, right? A hindrance. That was all he said, is see it, recognize it. When you see it, be on it, he said, right? Be on it right away so that you can let go of it, so that you can not get caught up, not get pulled down. That's the way I used to experience it. And so again, just it's in that seeing that there's some space, and that there's then the possibility. We see that we can do something. We see that there we do have choice. We can, in a sense, resist not getting pulled in. We can abandon it. We can let it go. So this is very simple, really, very ordinary. So these teachings, which are pointing us to transformative, to truly transformative practices, ways to transform our mind, our experience, to liberate our mind. And really, it's very ordinary. But the power of seeing this, that there can be space, that we can see before we get caught up. That we can see the nature of our thoughts, the effect of our thoughts, that we can practice restraint, we can practice letting go, and see for ourselves how we can liberate our thoughts, liberate our attachments, liberate our hindrances. And I wanted to end by just expressing my gratitude to the Buddha. I was feeling as I was working on this talk and coming to the end of the talk, kind of feeling the Buddha as a person, which I don't always. And so I had to offer gratitude to what he, to his, for his teaching, he shared his experience, and that has been passed down to us for us to use for ourselves.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.